Welcome to Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region. I'm Stella Fong. In this show, I take you to Bozeman, Montana to meet owner Anlieb Dawood and Chef Daniel Paris. We go to Saffron Table, located right off Main Street, in the remodeled building of Le Chatelaine Chocolate Company, and on the property once homesteaded by Anlieb's husband's family. We will learn about Eastern Indian and South Asia cuisine. But first, let's get to know these two people who create food with bold flavors. Anlieb shares her story first.
Well, I was born in England, and my parents are originally from India. They moved to Pakistan in 1948 after India and Pakistan were divided. They were partitioned into two countries. So they made kind of that big migration from India to Pakistan. It's a very dramatic story of how they left in the middle of the night very suddenly and had to make their way to what's now Pakistan. So I grew up actually in Karachi in Pakistan. My parents went back to Pakistan to live after I was born. They wanted me to grow up with a sense of culture and a sense of belonging, and they didn't really want me to grow up in England because they felt that I would have a very confused sense of identity if that happened. So they insisted that my sisters and I, grew up in Pakistan, and I grew up in a home that was about two blocks away from my grandmother's house. My grandmother's house, so my mother is the eldest of 11 children, and so my grandmother's house was this big joint family system, and because they were from a village in India originally, when they moved to Pakistan, they lived in a type of home called a haveli, which is a home where you also have kind of a little barnyard, like you have a little farm in the home. And so this is actually in the center of the city, but they ended up with a home where all the brothers lived with their wives and their children, my grandparents. And then all around the home there were like chickens, we had a water buffalo, we had a cow, we had goat, we had lots of herbs, chilies, lots of food growing, because again it's sort of like they were just trying to replicate village life, you know, in the middle of Karachi, which is today the second largest city in the world. So kind of like a strange sort of way to grow up, because it felt very simple, but so I kind of have this like urban culture, but with this like village life. A basic dinner at my grandmother's house was 15 to 16 people. Like that was kind of a normal night. And then when all my mother's sisters came over from their homes, you know, because the wives would go and live with their husbands, and my mother's sisters were all living with their husbands. And so when the sisters would come and the brothers were there, it was like these huge family dinners. Like we'd lay out a big cloth like on the floor of the biggest hallway in the house, and we'd sit on the floor and we'd all eat, and it was like these massive amounts of food that were being prepared. And it was so much fun growing up like that, because I had so many cousins and there was just tons of things constantly cooking, and all of them were being prepared by my aunts. So it wasn't like there was a big army of servants. It was like the family was preparing the food. That was part
of their
function.
Were you allowed into the kitchen?
Yeah, very much so.
Early on, or?
Early on, yeah. I wasn't necessarily allowed to do very much, but I was allowed to watch and allowed to taste and given lots of treats. And being in the kitchen was where you got to hang out with the aunts, you know. So that's where the family connection happened, was in the kitchen.
And then when did you come to the United States?
So I came to the United States, it was 1996. I came to go to college. I selected a school mainly because I got a big scholarship. So it was about 6 hours north of New York City, this little liberal arts college called William Smith College. Mm-hmm. It was complete culture shock for me, not because I hadn't been to the U.S. before, but I'd never been to a small town in the U.S., and especially not a small town in upstate New York. And I just didn't really know what to make of it. The way that I dealt with my kind of homesickness was really to teach myself how to cook some of the food that I'd grown up cooking, but not knowing how to cook. You know, it's sort of like you watch it, you're around it. You don't really, sometimes, like in my case, I didn't really ask for recipes because it was just all so right. Plentiful. So it was sort of like me trying to replicate what, like the tastes and the flavors that I'd grown up with, because that was what I missed the most, you know, like dining hall food. And I was just longing for that feeling of belonging, really, you know, is what I was missing.
Were you successful in recruiting a lot of the ingredients to reproduce those foods?
I had a pretty hard time, actually. Like, there was a big Wegmans grocery store in upstate New York, and they had a ethnic food aisle, and I was like, okay, I guess that's where I belong, in the ethnic food aisle. And they didn't have a lot of things, you know, they had a lot of kind of East Asian items, but not much from South Asia.
Probably Mexican items.
Yeah, Mexican. Yeah, but not, like, barely anything from India, right. Pakistan, you know. So I just sort of hacked it a lot. Calling my mom, being like, how do you make this? She'd be like, what's the big deal? You just take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, put it together, it's done. I'm like, no, it's not working, you know. Like, would you, like, give me a recipe? And it's just interesting because a lot of those cultures, those recipes are passed down by watching.
At Saffron Table, Anlieb hired Chef Daniel Paris a year and a half ago to execute many of the recipes she had managed to gather and recreate. So from growing up in Choteau, Montana, let's find out how Chef Daniel came to food.
My mother ran the household. She didn't work. She ran the house. There was a meal cooked every day at the table, fresh. And I don't think a lot of people got that experience growing up. I was very fortunate in that.
And you would watch her or would you help her?
I would watch for a little bit. I was a very independent child, very free-spirited. There was times where my parents would go grocery shopping or something and I'd stay home. And while they were gone, I'd make cinnamon rolls or blueberry muffins and stuff like that. My dad was a huge baker as well, not by profession, but an enthusiast. My grandmother lived with us as well. She's from the South, Alabama. So I got a nice taste of deep-seated tradition from her. So when I started going through high school, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. My senior year of high school, I discovered there was a culinary school in Missoula that was accredited by the CIA. So I looked into it, and it was affordable and close, so I could stay close to home. Ended up going to Missoula, got my culinary degree there. Ended up staying for a couple years, worked at a few places, just getting some good experience under my belt. But I was starting to get a little homesick, so I went back to Choteau, where my parents were living. Ended up working there for about 2.5 years.
Returning home only led Chef Daniel to other fortuitous possibilities.
I was walking home one night, and I always walked past the American Legion bar. And for no reason whatsoever, I decided I'm going to walk inside and have a beer.
And you've never been there before?
I never walked in there before. I walked past it many a time.
There was a calling.
Something told me, hey, just go inside and have a beer. And when I went inside, there are these three little old ladies getting toasted, having a great
time.
They're having a really good time, and they were the only ones in the bar. So naturally, I come over and I talk to them, and they had told me that they had just gotten back from a cruise, and they had a blast. They told me the whole story, how the food was just amazing and the service was impeccable, and they said, We know you, and we know how much you cook and what you've brought to our town, because there was only two restaurants in the town. And they said, I should go do that. And I said, you know what? I'm going to do that.
6 months later, Chef Daniel signed up with a cruise line.
Got the job almost instantly. Flew out to Alaska, and by sheer happenstance, I was hired as a relief sous chef. The gentleman that was the sous chef had just left due to medical reasons. So they instantly made me the sous chef for the rest of the season.
So burned by fire, literally.
Exactly. And my first chef there, his name was Dan Hoppe. That man was amazing. I learned so much from him. That was a big part of my career because you're working 7 days a week for weeks on end. My shortest stint was probably 8 weeks. My longest ended up being 3.5 months working straight. And that is just immersing yourself in as much as possible. The corporate chef took me under his wing in the second season. I ended up becoming the executive chef for that same ship and did a lot of recipe development as well for the whole company.
During the off season, Chef Daniel jumped on another ship in Hawaii. But in the second season, he came back to Montana to be with his brothers and to work at the Yellowstone Club in Big Sky at the Timberline Lodge, where going to work meant taking a ski lift.
That was an experience, I'll tell you what. Coming from sea level to 9,000 feet.
Could you not breathe for a while?
It was actually a problem. I found myself at least about every 2 hours, I just had to stop and just take deep breaths. I was definitely getting deprived of oxygen. But I started missing the sea life, so I reapplied to go back to Alaska from there. The positions were all taken. The only thing that was left was a executive pastry chef. So I said, you know what? Let's give that a shot.
So this makes you a very diverse chef.
Yes. And the chef I mentioned before, Dan Hoppe, an amazing chef, had worked 20 years in the industry, but he had never baked anything. And that really surprised me when I heard that. In my career, I always take the positives from all the people I work with and try to reflect them in the way I work. But I also learn from their mistakes. The one mistake I learned from Dan was, don't centralize yourself. You need a broad spectrum.
Chef Daniel left the seas for good and came back to land to Bozeman, where he
landed a position at Hilton Garden Inn Hotel. And that was very familiar to me because
feeding a lot of people.
That is definitely true. But cruise ships are hotels on water. So it was no different to me. The only thing that was different was there was no seasickness.
Which is a good thing.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Now, how did you two meet?
So, ended up working at other restaurants because I decided that hotels were not what I wanted to do anymore because I didn't want to centralize myself. Ended up at the Mint in Belgrade and had a great time there. I worked there for almost a year and a half. But in that time I was there, especially towards the end, I kept noticing I wanted to be a manager again. I wanted to teach. So I looked up online to see what kind of positions were available in Bozeman. And lo and behold, I found Saffron Table. I remember specifically in the interview, she said that it's extremely hard to find anybody in this town that knows anything about Indian food. So as long as I had the willingness to learn, I would be more than welcome to join the team.
Chef Daniel plays a major part of the team, but let's hear from An Lieb, the visionary of Saffron Table.
Did you have any culinary background before you started this restaurant?
No, only that I love to eat really good food. That was about it.
How did the idea of this restaurant come to be?
I have kind of had an interesting road to this restaurant. I've done a lot of different things. None of them really add up to owning a restaurant, per se. But where I found myself in my early 30s and kind of mid-30s, I opened the restaurant when I was 35, was looking for a way to feel I was doing something that mattered, that made a difference. And for me, the one way that I knew how to make a difference was by cooking for people. So I would have a lot of dinner parties, and I often made the food that I'd grown up with. That was one way that I knew that I could put a smile on people's faces, that if I could serve them really good food in a great, cheerful environment and kind of take away their troubles for a few hours, that was enough of a difference for me that I actually could change somebody's outlook on life. I wanted to create something that would make people happy, and I thought that this was a great way to do it.
The next time I'm troubled, I'm looking you up.
Come on over.
Why the name Saffron?
You know, saffron is a very precious spice in the world. I wanted to have a really fresh take on Indian cuisine. I wanted to do something that was refreshing, that was modern, that was taking kind of what people had known about Indian cuisine and putting a more innovative spin on it. And the table part was just, you're eating on a table. You know, that's where your food is served. So Saffron Table, that's where it came from.
Welcome back to the second part of Flavors Under the Big Sky, where Chef Daniel summarizes the personality of Indian food.
The best way I can describe it is bold. Just very bold, big flavors. That's how I see Indian cooking. I have yet to really come across subtlety. If there is, it's usually masked too well by other ingredients.
Indian food may be bold, but why is the cuisine of this region so diverse?
diverse, partly because that region has been around for so long. You know, like one of the oldest civilizations in the world was in Mohenjo-Daro, which is now in Pakistan. And it, you know, it's a civilization that existed in 5000 BC. And there's like a whole city that's standing there that they uncovered in the 1940s that have houses, like homes with little kitchens built into them and drainage, you know, before the Romans had drainage. And so it's still a culture that's been invaded by different cultures over the years. So as early as 1000 AD, you had the Turkish invaders coming through. We've had the Mongols coming through. We've had the Arabs come through. We've had the Persians come through. There's been the influences from China through the Silk Route. There has been influences through Central Asia through the Silk Route. So it's a cuisine that is very hard to pin down, say that, okay, this is Indian cuisine, just because it's influenced by so many different cultures. So I would say that the way that I think about the cuisine is really to think about it in terms of the different regions. So for example, in the northern parts of India, the cuisine is very heavily influenced by the Mughal Empire. And the Mughal Empire was an Islamic empire. And so there's a lot of these very rich stews and sauces. There is meat, there is chicken, there is these very rich stews and sauces. There is these braises, huge pot, on usually on a wood fire. So there's different kinds of techniques that were influenced either by the rulers of that area that were putting on a big show and then everybody else would emulate them. And or they were influenced by the climate. So like in southern India, it's much hotter, mostly defined by the Hindu culture. And so there's less meat, there's a lot of coconut milk, there is a lot more herbaceous sorts of spices growing, you know, in the region. There is more of like fermented rices and fermented lentils that are creating different kinds of breads that are used in the south. Whereas in the north, there is more rice. And then if you go all the way down to Sri Lanka, which is part of South Asia, the food is even more steeped in the traditions of South Asia. So it's like you've got more of that coconut milk because it's just dictated by what's growing in the region. So, you know, in terms of techniques, there's not a lot of ovens used in that part of the world because they don't really exist. The only kinds of ovens that are used are these cylindrical ovens called tandoor ovens. And we have one of those here in our kitchen. We use it to make our naan. You put the bread on the wall of the oven. It radiates heat on the wall of the oven, which has been kind of heated by coals usually at the bottom of the oven. So there, it's sort of like a combination of convection heat and radiant heat, as well as just like ambient heat mm-hmm. of the oven. So the bread rises on the wall of the oven. It takes 6 or 7 minutes. You peel the bread off the oven and you serve it. You also skewer meats a lot. So if you are making meats or vegetables, you'll put them on a skewer. Again, put them in the oven, could cook there, or it could be grilled. Like there's like grill cooking is very popular in that part of the world called sigiri. There's just a different word for grilling. And then there's a couple other techniques that are really popular. One is called karhai, which is basically, it's like an Indian wok. And so it's a form of stir fry cooking, kind of a fast cooking on a very high fire. There's also something called a handi or dum, which is basically slow cooking. So then again, that's defined by like a cook vessel that looks like a little pot. And that pot is designed again to hold heat so that it can cook on a low fire for a very, very long amount of time. And then as far as spices go, I mean, spices are one of the biggest components of the food. And the spice trade, it's interesting because the spices were coming from all over Asia, you know, as well as like coming from Europe. I mean, the Portuguese brought a lot of spicing techniques because they were traveling all the way from Portugal, all the way over to Indonesia, and they were stopping in India to pick up more spices. Right. Spices were traditionally a way to preserve food, to keep it from spoiling.
So spices played a practical role in extending food's longevity, but they also were an expression of flavor preferences.
Every single family has their own spice blend for garam masala, which is sort of like a blend of these warming spices. You know, every family will have their own chai masala blend that's defined by, again, where they're from.
Give some examples of those spices, you know, peppercorns or fenugreek or...
Yeah, so like a garam masala, it's usually warming spices, and those are things like black pepper, cinnamon, cumin. There is often a little bit of red chilies in there. There's some nutmeg in there, maybe some star anise in there. There is kind of the chai masala spices, mm-hmm. which will be things like ginger, cardamom, obviously the tea, the black tea that you're using, which could be from 3 or 4 different regions, you know, in India or Sri Lanka.
Here we think of curry as the spice combination found at the grocery store. But what is it really?
I mean, curry for us is usually means something that has a sauce. That's all curry means. And then there's obviously this curry spice, which we never use in the restaurant. And that was something that was developed by the British to make food taste like what they had in India. Mm-hmm. But it's not actually a traditional spice that's used in India very much. It's something used to replicate what people think of as Indian food.
Spices provide a versatile palate for cooking. So what's in Chef Daniel's repertoire?
My number one is a spice that I've never seen before until I started working here. It's called peepli, or long pepper. It's a type of black pepper. Looks like a little miniature pine cone. It has similarities to black pepper without the spice and a much sweeter smell to it. It's one of our main ingredients that goes in our vindaloo. I never really understood the diversification of cumin as well. We use a lot of cumin in our recipes.
In different formats?
In different ways. Because when you add a spice to a curry or a dish, when you put it in, changes. Changes the flavor, changes the texture. So if I have a recipe that says I need to put the cumin in the beginning or the middle or the end, it completely adds a different flavor each time.
And the form of it really changes the flavor as well. Like if it's toasted versus if it's ground, versus if it mixed with like two other spices and then added. There's like so many different flavors that come out of one spice, just depending on the technique that's used when you're preparing that dish.
Now let's pull up a chair at Saffron Table.
If I was coming to Saffron Table for the first time, what do you recommend a diner orders so that they get a good idea of what you serve here? A diner is intimidated by this type of cuisine because they're not familiar with it.
For sure.
So what's a great introduction for somebody?
The first question I know the servers tend to ask is, what's your tolerance to heat?
All right.
Because all the dishes have a varying level of spice to it, of the heat, I should say. Somebody who can't really take the heat, we always recommend the Goan seafood stew. There's a lot going on in that dish. There's some delicious flavors, but it seems to be very compatible with most people. I personally enjoy our beef biryani. That's my favorite one. There's a little bit of saffron rice, some braised beef that has a laundry list of spices that are absolutely delicious together. We use raita, and I always am a fan of balancing of texture, and we put some crispy onions on top of that dish.
Now to invite and introduce you to Saffron Table's offerings.
So I would say, I mean, our menu is really great because it gives you a lot of different options. So we have a section on our menu that's crispy bites. That's sort of like the little kind of snacky items that you might get if you're going to tea at someone's house and they'll offer you some pakoras, or they'll offer you just a little, you know, just a little something savory usually to have with your tea. Then we have a street food section. We have a lot of street food favorites from different regions in the area. I think the most popular one and my personal favorite is the eggplant chaat, because it is, you know, chaat is an onomatopoeia. It's like the sound of it. It's like chaat. It's like you're tasting it, you're licking it, you're like trying to, you know, feel every single texture in it. And that's exactly what the eggplant chaat is. So that is like a must have here at Saffron Table. And then we've got two sections of curries. We've got a bunch of vegetarian items that are also vegan, favorites from different parts of India. And then we've got some meat curries. So we've got some chicken curries, some beef curries. And then the Goan seafood dish is probably our mildest dish, but it has a lot of spice, but not a lot of heat to it. So, and that's got some tamarind, some coconut milk. That's influenced by a region in India called Goa, which is on the Arabian Sea. And then the section that is kind of my favorite section of the menu, partly because it really is what this restaurant is about. It's like some of the contemporary, more modern Indian dishes. Mm-hmm. And our fish of the day on that section is my favorite because it's...
And I love that you call that category mains to dive into. And when you were talking about curry, also curry in a hurry.
Yeah.
So there's a playfulness in the categories that you have in your menu. And I think that should make it more light for people to come in and less afraid of ordering off the menu.
And our servers, I mean, like, we love to tell people about what we're doing here because we understand it's not something that folks around here have had an opportunity to experience, really. And it's like our privilege, you know, to be able to share this with our guests and our diners and really encourage those kinds of questions. So the fish of the day uses my mom's hara masala. A masala is a blend of spices. It's any blend of spices. And this is kind of a blend of kind of the green spices. So there's some coriander in there. There's green chilies is mainly the heat in there. But it's a pretty mild sauce. It's full, again, it's like full of like this really juicy, fresh flavor. And then we bring in fresh fish, and usually we've got access to a wild-caught Alaskan black cod, which we rub with a little bit of spice and then put on the grill. And then we serve that with a couple of little chickpea cakes that have a little bit of red pepper and a little bit of onion and a little bit of coriander in it. And it is just to die for. It's like my favorite. So, and then we've got, obviously, our naans, which, like, you can't really leave here without having a naan. So that's the fresh bread that we make. It's baked to order. It's baked in that tandoor oven. The tandoor oven is kept at about 700 degrees, super hot. It's the first test for a new cook in the kitchen is, can they stick their hand in there and slap a naan on the wall?
It's no fear kitchen.
Yeah, as Anne Lieb is talking about this, Daniel is pointing to the burn mark on his arm. So I think he passed his test, but there are a few scars.
Yeah, we've lovingly nicknamed our tandoor Tammy. Yeah, and Tammy likes to kiss. So.
Yeah, there you go.
Leaving hickey marks. Yeah. You were talking about the innovative parts of your menu. I see that there's grits with tandoori prawns.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, grits.
Mm-hmm.
One would never think about that in a restaurant like this.
Yeah.
Also, steamed buns with lamb. Mm-hmm. So tell me about those. Daniel, why don't you start with that?
The steamed buns are a definite labor of love. The steam buns are made by my prep crew by hand several times a week to keep them as fresh as possible, but there's a triple rise to the process, so it takes quite a long time to get that risen each time and then rolled out, and then we steam them and hold them and then re-steam them to order.
And you fill them with lamb, and how is that prepared?
The lamb vindaloo, another intense project. It's a 4 to 5 hour braise on that lamb, infusing with several different spices like cinnamon, whole dried chilies, caramelized onion. And then when that is finished, we break it apart and shred it. And then that gets portioned into the steam bun.
Shrimp and grits, not typical Indian fare. So why is this dish on the menu?
I wanted to make our food accessible, like something that would be recognizable, you know, to people here in Montana. And while shrimp and grits are really more of a southern homage, maybe to Daniel's southern roots here, what we've done is we've marinated the shrimp with a really lovely, delicious Indian style spicy marinade. So it's got some red chilies, some ginger, some turmeric, and that sort of sits in the marinade. And then we grill them in the tandoor oven. So they're actually skewered and put in the oven, grilled to perfection in the oven, and they're served with grits that we cook down with fenugreek. So it's a fenugreek grit. And just to order, we give it a little saute to make it a little crispy grit. So it's almost like a little crispy polenta. And then the sauce on that's got Kashmiri chili. And Kashmiri chili is, it's a type of red chili that doesn't have a lot of heat to it, but it's got this really long, beautiful flavor that lingers in your palate, but without the heat. So it doesn't hurt, but it really lets its presence be known. Coriander in it, it's got some ginger and garlic, it's got just a tiny bit of cream. It's one of the few sauces that actually uses a little bit of cream in the kitchen.
Much to my embarrassment, I almost left without asking about dessert, but Chef Daniel proudly shared this delectable ending.
We do these wonderful little chocolate-filled samosas with an apricot chutney and hazelnut ice cream. That is definitely our number one selling dessert. People absolutely love that one. And it's really nice too. A touch of garam on the chocolate really brings those warming spices into the plate, as well as the sweetness of the apricot chutney. And everything on that plate is made in-house.
But it is not just dessert that's made from scratch.
I'd say 95% of everything that we do here is made in-house, because you can't just order this stuff. We have to make it.
We take a lot of pride in following those kind of really ancient processes. I was talking to somebody about dropping something off, and they said, when do your prep cooks come into the kitchen? I said, oh, there's someone here at 7 in the morning. And they were like, but aren't you only open for dinner? Yeah, we're open for dinner, but it takes us all day and about 5 people a day to get ready just for dinner service at 5 o'clock, you know. So I wanted a restaurant with that kind of integrity where the food is going through all of the processes needed to make it as feeding and nurturing and warming as it could possibly be, because ultimately I wanted to put a smile on people's faces. That's what it's there for, you know, and you can't rush that. You have to put your heart and soul into it.
Many thanks to Anne Lieb Dawood and Chef Daniel Paris for bringing bold flavors to our lives. Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region, has been produced with the help of Ken Seabird. Theme music is by Parker Brown. For more information about this show, go to ypradio.org. I'm Stella Fong.